Well, hey, everybody, again. Welcome back to X-Files Diaries. I'm Annie.
I'm Jen.
And today, we are going to continue our mythology series. It's been a while, huh, Jen? We haven't been digging into the mythology. We've had a lot of other stuff going on X-Files Diaries. But we decided...
It's happening.
Yeah, it's time to dig back in. Hopefully we haven't forgotten everything that we've already discussed.
Yeah, we'll see, I guess. We'll find out. But that's the danger with the mythology. It always is, because there is always months between the episodes. So this will just be like a real-time experience.
It's interesting because it does feel, it does feel that way. We aren't necessarily binging this the way that one could. We are kind of doing all these different things in between. But I think
that's the way they air. That's the way the episodes air. There was always like, you know, September, November, February, May. So there wasn't like, you didn't have the opportunity to just go and rely on your memory. So this is a more authentic experience. So we'll see how much I can remember. I have a feeling you will do better on the memory thing than I will. So we'll find out.
Well, I'm excited. We are going to today to be talking about Colony and Endgame. But first, let's read some tweets.
He's made outrageous public statements on an internet site.
That wasn't him. That was me. And they're not outrageous.
Okay, tweets of the week. These are in response to our interview with the wonderful Paul Terry, who is the author of the fantastic X-Files Official Archives, which is this spectacular book that we should all do our damnedest to get our hands on because it's an amazing book. And folks obviously enjoyed hearing from Paul. And we got a lot of great tweets in response from Jessica. Jessica says, a terrific listen. The mythology in the traditional or in the broader context espoused by Paul was always the draw for me. No other TV was as nuanced in world depiction and characterization. Enthusiastic answers from Paul and a Herculean effort on the book. Thanks, Annie and Jen. Thank you, Jessica. Well said. Definitely. From Kathy G. Kathy G says, fantastic interview. I loved hearing that Paul is one of us. I mean, haven't we all paused the episode to get really close to the screen and analyze every detail? And when he said, they've always loved each other, it's just been a long journey and a very complicated one. And then Kathy gives us the hard eyes emoji, and rightly so for that.
Yeah.
Monica Filefan said, I love this. Paul did such a fab job with the details and just making sure the love of the show bled through each page was so good. And she quotes Paul, I watched to watch the relationship play it on screen and how that's affected by the cases they investigate. OMG, yes, the MSR is the story. Absolutely, Monica Filefan. And Paul gets that too. And Daniela says, similarly, such a lovely chat with Paul Terry. And how refreshing to hear a guy caring so much about the relationship aspects of the mythology and such painstaking efforts to put the details of the book together. Thanks, all of you, for the great listen. That I when I read Daniela's tweet, I kind of feel like maybe she was emphasizing the word a guy caring so much about the relationship aspects of the mythology. Like, I mean, I don't like to generalize, but there's no doubt that the majority of shippers are female. But Paul is a great reminder that there are some guys out there that are shipping it up as well.
Yeah.
And we appreciate the guys, the gals, the non-binary folks, everybody is welcome in shipperdom.
Mm-hmm.
My husband is a big time shipper in his fandoms. So I know what it's like. There are guys who like to ship it up and I love it.
Or they do. They're just not as loud about it.
Yeah. Maybe they don't obsess over it quite as much as we do. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or they may be out there thinking they're the only ones. Like,
right.
I'm the only guy who's the shipper in the room, so I'm not going to like draw attention to myself. But
please tell us.
Yeah, exactly. There's probably more than we realize because, we tend to be kind of loud sometimes as chicks. But there's all of the genders are represented in shipperdom and we love them and love that. From Emily Page Ballou. Hi, Emily. This was such a joyful episode and I was really interested to hear that the date of the office fire came straight from Chris Carter because it's the anniversary of another date within the mythology. And I was wondering whether anyone's caught it. Okay, Annie. Now, Emily points out that she's thinking that this is the anniversary of the Duane Barry episode in the fact that it's date stamped August 7th. But you pointed out another significance of the date of the fire.
Well, first of all, the date of the fire is the 8th, August 8th. And the abduction, I do believe, is on the 7th. But the date, the 8th, is just a kind of interesting Easter egg that only the truly crazy would know. That's the date between David and Jillian's birthdays. Because David's is August 7th and Jillian's is August 9th. And so sticking that date or that office fire like right between them, I thought was such a cool little thing. And we all know how, I think somebody actually responded this, that how Chris Carter feels about like birthdays and the significance of dates and stuff like that. And so, I mean, I think that if that was intentional, well done, Chris Carter. And if that was a coincidence, it's a freaky coincidence.
It's a really good coincidence. And so now I'm thinking the office fire was August 8th. Now we know, is that correct? And that would have been, it's 2008, right? So are we talking 888 there? 2000?
No. The office August fire was 8th. In 98.
Or 1998, I mean.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 2008. Yeah, right.
I was like, that's 10 years too late.
1998, but I'm thinking there's three eights in that date, which is considered very lucky in several different cultures, especially Asian cultures. So there's significance to that, maybe coincidental. Who can say?
Well, in a way, it brought them closer together because they realized that they still wanted to fight the fight together even without this job that was tying them to each other. And I think that's really significant. I love it.
Well said. From Isa or Isa, I-S-A, fantastic interview. I was already amazed at the quality of the book, but I didn't know that Paul Terry was such a huge fan like us. That explains why it's so good. Thank you, Paul, for all your attention to every single detail. Absolutely. That's exactly why. Yeah. Karen Rain Knight points out a couple of great details. Karen says, what a great interview. Where do I even begin? It's so cool to have it verified that Paul is just as obsessive about the show as the rest of us, though I think it's pretty obvious from the extreme attention to detail in the book, for sure. It was so interesting to hear about the process of putting everything together and of the thought involved in capturing Mulder and Scully's voices and constructing the in-universe narrative. This book is such a work of art. It really is. And Paul, thank you for bringing up that Pendril's first name was included in the X-Files PC game. That's where I thought I remembered first seeing it. And then Karen actually goes back and checks, and she finds the strategy guide from the game and tweeted out a picture from that. And indeed, from the strategy guy, Pendril is identified as Sean Pendril. So there we have it, straight from the horse's mouth of the strategy guide for the X-Files PC game from way back when. And that was Paul's recollection of where the name came from. And like everything else, Paul's recollection was very accurate.
I enjoy the receipts.
Absolutely. Karen bringing us the receipts. So thank you, Karen. Isadub said, a wonderful episode of X-Files Diaries podcast, an amazing book that I was able to buy. Full of incredible details and made with intelligence, heart, and love for the series and MSR. It's the treat we all need these days. So true, Isabel. Could not agree more. And that's a positive note to end on, I think. So thanks for those tweets, everybody. And once again, we highly recommend Paul's book, The X-Files Official Archives. Do try to get your hands on it if you can. And tweet at us at any time on anything X-Files related at XFD Podcast. And we look forward to seeing you there.
Mulder, the internet is not good for you.
All right, Jen. So, Colony. A little bit of trivia. Most people might know this, but Colony and Endgame were the first episodes that Frank Spotnitz was brought on board to work on for the show. And that will definitely come up later because I have noticed a few amazing parallels in these episodes with some later Frank episodes. But what was your overall vibe? I love this two-parter. I think it's great. It feels so classically X-Files. I mean, it's, situated smack dab in the middle of season two. where the I think it's post Scully's abduction. So the myth arc is sort of really starting to get going here. Mm-hmm. I want to say even like since Scully's abduction for the first time, because even though we've had a lot of mythology already so far, it's been sort of more based on the general idea of alien abduction and like the government cover ups and that sort of stuff. And now it's a lot more personal. So what was your takeaway from watching this two-parter?
That's a great point about how the mythology becomes so much more personal with Scully's abduction, and that sort of personal aspect of it continues through this two-parter. I loved this two-parter. When I was rewatching it, I realized how many times I must have rewatched it back in the day, because I knew so many of the lines really well. It was like, I know what everyone's going to say next, because I'd watched it so many times. So this was obviously a favorite of mine. And yeah, wow, we got a lot in season two. Hey, we had the whole abduction, and then boom, still in the middle of the season, we're getting Colony and Endgame, and then great things to come at the end of the season as well. So, man, we were fed well with some fine mythology in season two, and it started with Little Green Men, which is also a favorite of mine. So, what a great season all the way around. And this is a great two-parter. It is like we are really starting to solidify a bit more of the actual myth arc. I mean, I feel like in season one, I love the season one mythology episodes, but they are a little bit sort of like vignettes, little bits and pieces, sort of. There's not as much of a through line, a sort of continuity of story. It's more like we're just getting puzzle pieces at that point. Here we're starting to see things start to sort of like a narrative is starting to be shaped. Mm-hmm. And it's really starting to have a direction.
Yeah.
And that was exciting at the time, I remember. And I love this two-parter, because there's a lot going on, but for me, there's not too much going on. It's just the right amount going on. I'm sort of confused the whole time, but in a good way. And a lot of stuff really comes together, and it's got some nice thematic elements to it. It's not just about plot, and some great character moments, some great MSR moments. So there's just a lot to love about these two episodes.
I think this two-parter is a really good example of them throwing in a lot of stuff that, like you said, as you're watching it, you're kind of like, oh my God, this is too much. I can't process all of this. But then at the end of the day, when you actually really think about what you've watched, it's quite simple. Like in terms of just the information they've dropped and the information that they've given us and the little threads that they're weaving in terms of what is going on with the aliens? Like, what is their purpose? Why are they here? Why, how did they get here? I mean, we don't really find that out for a few more seasons, but the seeds are all here. Like all of the little parts that we are going to reveal later are here. Yeah. And I think maybe most importantly is this is the first episode we see the alien bounty hunter, correct?
I think it is. I was trying to remember that myself.
Yeah.
And I do believe this is the first time we see him.
It is. And we actually see him. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I feel like I always miss this and always forget this, but we actually see him crash land because...
Yeah, we do. That's
the flight. Him. Yeah, the UFO essentially crashes in the Arctic again. Mm-hmm. We're back in the Arctic, back to the ice. This ice theme has been going on since season one and continues obviously all the way up through Fight the Future.
Cold places is where the action is.
Yeah, because, and as we learn, the virus, so to speak, can lay dormant in the cold, which is something that they pick up again all the way into season eight, which I'm going to bring up later, obviously. But I like the idea that is here and that carries on. That's just telling us more information about the virus and how it kind of survived and how it kind of lived and how it can sort of be contracted, which I think is interesting. But so we have the ABH. I just have ABH, which is Alien Bounty Hunter. If I do say ABH, everyone, that's what I mean.
Yeah, I have ABH too.
But yeah, actually, and I meant to pull up the name of the actor. I think it's Brian Thompson.
I want to say Brian Thompson.
Yeah. Let me look it up while we are talking about him. But yeah, this is his first episode. And I think that he is so cool. Yeah, it's Brian Thompson. Very well cast.
He's great.
Like, yeah, scary. But like it almost is like the aliens are like, okay, if we're going to make a really intimidating human, what is he going to look like? And like, this is what you would come up with. Like, this is the Frankenstein-ish type creature that they would think this is the most intimidating kind of human we can make.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like they watched a lot of Arnold Schwarzenegger movies and thought, okay, let's try to make one of those.
It worked
because he is scary.
It makes me think of, have you seen the movie Galaxy Quest?
I have not.
Oh, you must, Jen. It's so funny.
Okay.
But the idea that like the aliens have been watching like our television shows, and they think that they think it's real. Like they think that they call them historical documents. And so essentially they're watching this Star Trek knockoff, and they mimic what they've seen on the television show to be like, oh, this is our best guess as to what this would, you know, we are going to do this because it works for you. And it's brilliant. It's one of,
that's great.
It's such a good movie. Anyway, everyone should see it. But it reminded me of that because it's like, okay, this is the image that they would come up with. Because
that's exactly it.
When you said Arnold Schwarzenegger movies, that was perfect. So he crash lands.
He's great. And I feel like he talks quite a bit in these episodes. Like, feel like sometimes in later episodes, I'm not sure he speaks at all in some of the later episodes.
Maybe they decided to reel it back because not only does he talk quite a bit, but he talks obviously quite a bit disguised as other people.
Yeah.
And
like, I always say the alien bounty hunter is the best actor that you could find, because he doesn't just, you know, he obviously can transform to look like other people, but he really does a great job of acting like them too.
Yeah.
So he's very talented.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when he changes into, what is the, it's a great name. Ambrose Chapel. I don't know.
Ambrose Chapel. Agent Chapel.
That sounds like such a great name. Like, I have this list of like amazing X-Files names that I've written down, and that has to go on the name on the list because it's really good.
I like but, Agent Chapel as a name.
Yeah, it's a good name. And I mean, the idea, and he also changes into, what is it, Agent Weiss was the other one
who gets that's
killed.
Right.
Yeah. So he's.
And Mulder, of course.
He's doing a lot of.
Those people really well.
He's an alien, and yet he's doing a really good job. Yeah.
I mean, he's like super robotic when he's ABH, but then as soon as he turns into somebody else, you can't tell.
Yeah.
He's not like acting really weird kind of like Stepford Wife kind of like robot-like kind of performance. He seems very human. So I feel like he studied his roles really well.
He's
and
a method
does a
actor.
Fine job.
Yeah.
He is a method actor and does a really great job with it.
Love it. Love it. I wanted to bring up these doctors, obviously these clone doctors, because one of the big aspects that we get here for the first time is this concept of cloning. And I mean, I feel like other than Scully's abduction, we haven't gotten a whole lot of information on exactly what like these quote unquote colonists that we later find out are working with the syndicate, but we don't know that yet, are working on. And it's like a lot of different, seemingly different types of projects. But I like that because it's like they're put all over the country or all over the world. They're in these different locations and they're doing this stuff with like, I guess the stem cells or the fetal tissue, or what did she say later?
Yeah.
Like they want to do it in these abortion clinics because they have access to all this tissue. So, which I think again is another thing. It wasn't even the thing I was going to bring up earlier, but another thing that really tracks with season 8 and the storyline that we get in the later mythology in terms of these experiments being done, making alien babies. Like we get it right here at the beginning, and Scully sees one actually, which we can talk about later, which I think is hilarious. But but I love the idea that this fertility/abortion clinic is another kind of scare. It's a scary thing to think about that, like, they're in there and they're messing with your stuff, with your business, making babies, and you don't know what they're going to be doing. But it's another one of those great X-Files things where they make something scary that is kind of already mysterious, but they make it even scarier.
Yeah. I see exactly what you're saying. That's the sort of that whole sort of body horror vibe.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's very cool. And just like the whole concept of like hybrids, alien-human hybrids, it's right there. It's spelled right out. The reasoning for the creation of the hybrids is explained in this context as being, I think if I understood it correctly, as just existing to make the different doctors, or Gregors as I think they're called.
Right.
Trying to vary their appearance more. That's the explanation that's given, I think, for why they want to create these alien human hybrids, why they want to bring in this sort of the human sort of DNA into it, which is a, it's kind of That sort of explanation for why it's happening changes a little bit over the years, but that's the explanation we're given now. And then, of course, we get a totally different set of explanations, which turn out to be, of course, a big lie from pretend Agent Chapel when the alien bounty hunter takes over his body and gives a whole story to Mulder and Scully. I'm getting a little ahead of myself,
yeah.
Of course.
Well, that's okay. We can get ahead.
But we get a whole story there again about, and I think that's one of the reasons why I get a little confused when I watch these episodes, is because that's the first version we hear, is the fake version from fake Agent Chapel, mm-hmm. About that these are Russian spies and that there's, and it's a very convoluted story about how
right.
the Soviets figured out how to isolate the gene that creates twins, and then they created a bunch of other.
I mean, it's a huge red herring.
Twins. Yeah. And so, and then, you know, planted them in America and all this kind of thing. And all I can think is, why would they have to be identical? What would be the point of having spies that all look the same? But of course, none of that has to make sense because it's all a made up story anyway.
Right.
But I think I spend so much time trying to get my head around that version of the story that I sometimes forget, no, that's not actually the truth.
Right.
There's a whole other version of the story that we hear later. That's the actual truth.
Right.
And so there is some confusion there, created on purpose.
Right.
Because, you know, we're not meant to know right away that that's not an accurate explanation for the purpose of the hybrids or anything like that.
Yeah.
But it does add to the general sense of kind of like fun confusion.
Right.
That's, I always feel like at this stage in the mythology, being confused is still kind of fun because it feels very deliberate and kind of cool and kind of like, oh my God, I don't know what's happening. That's all fun for me. It gets less fun for me as the years go on. But at this stage, feeling confused is still feels very planned, deliberate, and it sort of pays off well.
Right. And I mean, it's also you even doubt yourself after you've watched it because you can't remember who gave you the news. And oh wait, was that guy a bad guy? Was it a bounty hunter? Was it this guy? Wait, what? And then I think a lot of stuff just kind of fades into the background or like kind of makes its way into your subconscious as like fact. Mm-hmm. And you're like, but they said that. And then you kind of forget that, wait, no, that wasn't really the truth.
Yeah,
I mean, I think,
right.
Again, like you said, it's all by design, which I think is, it can get frustrating, but at the same time, it's part of the fun. You're trying to figure it out.
Is.
Trying
to piece it together. You got to be on your game. And there's so many other interesting character-driven things happening in these episodes that it's easy to sort of lose track of the sort of extensive facts that we're being given. There's quite a lot mm-hmm. of exposition in these episodes that if you are sort of taking careful note, pays off really well, both within these episodes and in episodes to come. But there's so many other interesting things happening that it's, for me, when I'm watching it, it's easy to lose track of all the sort of the sort of info dump that happens.
Well,
but
a lot of the time,
I just tried to study it a little harder this time.
Yeah, and a lot of the time, like, you're busy, like, staring at, like, how pretty Mulder and Scully look, and then you kind of, your brain just kind of gets fuzzy, and then you forget, because you end up starting to sort of care about some of the character stuff that goes on in this a little bit more, like, mm-hmm. in terms of Bill Mulder and Tina Mulder and Samantha and all that. That, to us, in this moment, is so much more interesting and so much more compelling that it's really easy to forget a lot of these details. You let them wash over you and then they go away, but they're there. They're still there.
Mm-hmm.
Which
that's absolutely true. At that point, those sort of character moments feel almost more important, mm-hmm. even though they turn out completely to be not important. But at the time, it feels like, oh my God, it's Samantha Mulder.
Right.
And so, yeah. And for me, just I'm a whore for characterization. And so any of those kind of character events are what tend to grab me, as well as anything remotely MSR related. And so that's where all of my love and affection and attention is drawn to. But there is a lot of other, you know, very sort of compelling stuff going on here when I tear myself away from the other things and try to pay careful attention.
Yeah. And I think this one in particular, this two-parter, does such a great deal, speaking of characterization, does a great deal towards building Mulder's character and sort of explaining kind of mm-hmm. why he is the way he is, or why he, you know, and even his family dynamic. I mean, there's a lot here while telling us very little, while giving us very little, we get a lot out of it, I think. And I think a lot of that help, actually, I wanted to read one of my favorite actually Frank Spotnitz written, I think, I believe, maybe. He did Colony and Endgame, or just Endgame?
He did not. Because you know what? I was doing my notes, and I wrote down, I always write down the director and the writer for each episode, and I had already written down for Colony, Chris Carter and Frank Spotnitz, except Frank Spotnitz's name is not on Colony.
It's David.
You know whose name's on there.
David Duchovny. Yeah.
It's listed as teleplay Chris Carter, story by Chris Carter and David Duchovny. I always forget that David Duchovny's name is on Colony. Mm-hmm. I don't know exactly what he contributed, but obviously enough to get his name in the credits in terms of, if I have to guess, it's probably some Mueller-related stuff.
Yeah, I believe it. And I'm wondering, too, if this monologue I'm about to read is David, because it sounds a little less Chris Carter-y, if that makes sense.
Is this the one at the very beginning?
And I'm going to read
it. I wrote down in my notes that the opening monologue is actually interesting and insightful, which I rarely say about opening monologues. I've complained heartily about monologues on The X-Files, but this is one of the better ones.
I would love to know if David wrote this, because this is it. I have lived with a fragile faith built on the ether of vague memories from an experience that I can neither prove nor explain. When I was 12, my sister was taken from me, taken from our home, by a force that I came to believe was extraterrestrial. This belief sustained me, fueling a quest for truths that were as elusive as the memory itself. To believe as passionately as I did was not without sacrifice, but I always accepted the risks to my career, my reputation, my relationships, to life itself. And, okay, that's it. And I feel like it's easy to follow. It's not words that humans don't say, which
yes.
I think Chris Carter tends to do.
Yes.
It feels very Mulder. It feels very personal, and it gives you a lot of information about him, like that we don't really know in terms of like his past and kind of the way he moved through life as from a child to a man. And I think that that's really, it's one of my favorite monologues. I just would be really curious to know exactly who wrote it. And if Chris did write it, I apologize. I just think it's great.
I totally agree. I think it is a very different style than typical Chris Carter monologues.
Yeah, right?
And
okay.
If he did write this, then it almost makes me a bit mad, because then it's like, well, dude, if you can write this, you should have written all of them like this.
Yeah.
Because you're right. It's like, it's still beautifully written. It's not, you know, it's not mundane or boring,
mm-mm.
But, you know, you don't need to write purple prose for something to be beautifully written.
No, and it still sounds like Mulder. Like, it's very...
It sounds like something Mulder would say.
Yeah.
And it's very well written, and it does like pack a lot of information in there. And mm-hmm. So we learn something. It's not just blah, blah, blah. What the hell are we even doing here?
Right.
Which is how I feel with a lot of monologues. But it actually delivers information that contributes to sort of the themes of these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very sort of. It just draws you in and really well delivered by David as well. So, yeah, that's probably might be my very favorite monologue. I'll have to see if anything surpasses it in future episodes.
Definitely one of my favorite Mulder monologues, for sure.
For sure.
And I think that what I also love about it is that it really it harkens, I should say, forward to some of the themes, like you said, that come up in this episode, like the idea that he tells Scully at one point after that agent gets killed, he's like, these are the risks we take. Like he gives her that little speech, which I actually really like. Like that he's like, this is our path. Like, this is the risks that we take. If you don't like the heat, get out of the kitchen, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
yep.
And she likes the heat, maybe in more ways than one. But I actually enjoy that he says that to her and is able to sort of express that, even knowing how it's affected him. And the idea that it kind of plays into his relationship with his parents, which we see later, which is also a relationship, quote unquote, that he was referring to earlier, as well as, you know, who knows how many others. And the concept of him in Endgame, essentially pulling a Mulder ditch, but like, because he doesn't want Scully to have to do that, even though she chooses to. Every time. He doesn't want her to have to make the risks that he's making because, you know, it's affected him so much. And I feel like we don't really get, we get that probably over and over in the series, but I feel like it's told very well in this two-parter, like that story, that particular
Absolutely.
Story of Mulder and sort of his guilt and sort of the way he's been affected by it. And so I really enjoy that a lot.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right that it's nicely brought up in that opening monologue, and it carries through quite sort of clearly through these two episodes. I think the positioning of these episodes being the first mythology episodes technically, since the abduction is significant in the sense that probably Mulder is more aware of the cost of his quest and specifically the effect on Scully. I suspect that has something to do with his decision to ditch her, and he might be feeling a little extra protective of her. But yeah, they have like this sort of very overt discussion about, you know, where do you draw the line? And, you know, Scully brings it up, you know, she recognizes, she says, you know, you pursue a case at the expense of everything to the point of insanity and expect me to follow you. There has to be somewhere to draw the line.
Right.
And then Mulder refers back to that later on when he says, you know, I'm drawing the line for you, instead of basically explaining why he ditches her. And I mean, I love this because this is all so very much like the conversations they have way back, way ahead in Requiem in season 7, because, you know, the conversation they have in the motel, the conversation they have in the hallway at the FBI, it's almost the exact same thing where they're talking about, you know, Mulder again asserting there has to be an end, and Mulder sort of asserting that he's decided this ought to be the end for Scully.
Yeah.
And so that's a concept that is very consistently revisited throughout the series.
And revisited by Scully. I mean, I know somewhere later when we get to season 4, I feel like maybe it's in the Tunguska Terma two-parter, she says something very similar. Like, I don't know how much further I can follow you. How far are you willing to go? And am I going to be able to follow you? She always does. Until I want to believe, which is worth pointing out, because at that point, she's reached her limit, and it always confuses me when people find that out of character or unusual, when I'm like, look, Scully's had it. She's done. Like, she's been done for a long time, but she follows him because she loves him, and she's it gets to a certain point where she's like, no, we're done. Yep. Like, and I do think that they have compellingly laid out a case for her to make that decision at that point in their relationship.
But obviously this is an issue that Scully is aware of as early as here.
As early as here. Yep.
And it's not like Mulder gets any better over the years.
No.
He remains just as obsessed.
Yeah.
Up at least until the, you know, season 10, perhaps season 10, 11, maybe there's a little bit of variation there, but certainly up until I Want to Believe, if anything, he gets more and more obsessed. So of course, this is something she's concerned about and, you know, emotional and kind of angry about in season 2. I mean, would we respect her as a character if she put up with that forever when it clearly is something that bothers her? Of course, you know, eventually she's got it. She did eventually draw her own line.
Yeah.
And she was talking about it as early as this. And of course, eventually that's going to happen.
Yeah. And I'm sure that this conversation that they have is going, like I said, is going to come up multiple times between now and then. And we will be sure to point it out. I'm excited about that.
I'm always very interested. It's such a heart of the Mulder Scully dynamic, this concept of Mulder's quest and Scully's connection to it and the connection and how that influences their relationship and how the relationship exists separate from that. And so I find that all really interesting.
Yeah. And also worth pointing out that it's not something that he is making her do. She is making that choice on her own.
Absolutely.
And he
attempts to make the choice for
her
to leave her out of it.
Multiple times.
He thinks he's doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I mean, I think there's a good case to be made that I'm not always crazy about the various Mulder ditches, but I think there's a pretty good case to be made that that in this particular two-parter, the ditch is probably well-intentioned and probably comes from a solid place, because really he is just going off and doing crazy things at that point and she has expressed these concerns already to him. And so it's understandable why he would want to kind of say, okay, I'm out and you're out. And so she's always, of course, ready to pursue it and to pursue him. He's the only one that's trying to say no here.
Right. I do love the fact that we're constantly riding the line with Scully in particular, but with both of them, between her wanting to sort of assert herself and say, I can make my own decisions and I can do all of the things that you can do, which she absolutely can, and Mulder's need or desire to protect her, which I appreciate and understand as, you know, a softie. And as a shipper, I enjoy that. And so yeah. I'm kind of constantly always battling with myself, is like, but no, Scully can take care of herself. But Mulder, he wants to protect her. Yeah. And I mean, I love both things simultaneously. And I think, yeah. I think we can. I mean, I think that's the joy of this show. So I enjoy that.
I agree totally. And like I said, I can especially understand it in the context of Scully's abduction having happened so recently that Mulder would be especially conscious of the impact of his quest on her. So absolutely. I think that his behavior makes total sense to me in this case.
Absolutely. Okay, so I would like to talk about Bill Mulder and Tina Mulder. Mm. The first thing I wanted to point out, and I'm sure you noticed this, I love the way they introduce him like Smoking Man. Love it.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
I mean, I will admit, I've never really noted the fact until this week that Bill Mulder is smoking a cigarette the first time we see him.
Yep. And you know what else is interesting? And I know people are going to hate me and jump down my throat for this, but you know who else is smoking a cigarette when we first see them?
Is it Monica Reyes?
Yep. I just find that so cool and just a really kind of cool foreshadowing of what is to come. I just think that's cool.
It is. I mean, cigarettes are not just cigarettes on the X-Files. I think we can say that. Especially when the way Bill Mulder is introduced, that he's lighting up the cigarette, he's in shadow.
Yeah.
He looks very CSM at that moment.
Yep.
So,
and I mean,
I don't know why I never noticed that before, but I just noticed it.
There's something cool that I'm going to point out to when we get to, I believe it's Paperclip, which I think might be our next mythology arc, which is exciting. But it just, like, lots of these little things, like little clues that are put, like, dispersed throughout the early mythology that indicate to me that they knew, or at least Chris Carter knew in the back of his mind, that there was going to be, like, a Smoking Man is Mulder's father kind of storyline at some point. And I mean, I feel like they started that dynamic right off the top. Like he comes up and he tries to hug him and he's not having it. And I mean, it's rough, right?
It's rough. Man, I wrote down Bill Mulder's an asshole because he's very sort of contained, isn't he? He's just, he's got
tightly
the emotions,
wound.
But he's not letting them out. Yeah, tightly wound and just very kind of, he's kind of a jerk to Mulder. Not without cause at times throughout the episodes. But he doesn't make a great first impression as a dad.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's without cause or not without cause. I don't really think he has any cause to be irritated at Mulder. But I mean, I also, at this point, there's a lot of information we don't have. I mean, we have because we've seen all the episodes, but like at this point, we're probably meant to think, what the fuck's going on with Bill Mulder? Why is he acting like an asshole? What's up with their relationship? I mean, is this one of the relationships that Mulder was referring to in that wonderful monologue? Yes, absolutely it is.
But, spoiler alert, it is.
Yeah, but I do love that. Like, it's a tiny little moment and it tells you so much about their relationship, and I think that's
so
great.
Everything like you said, we learn a lot about Mulder's family relationships, and it's done in the best possible way, in the sense that we are shown and not told. There's all these little details in terms of how Mulder interacts with his dad, interacts with his mom. It's just very subtle but rich with information.
I was just talking to a friend about this the other day who we were watching Lost. We were rewatching Lost together. And there's an episode. I don't know. Did you watch Lost?
I did not.
Okay.
I watched the first half of the first episode and said, no, I don't think this is for me.
Well, it's, I love it. But I, without giving any going into this too much, there's just a scene where, you know, one of the main characters, Jack, and his dad, they have this whole buildup of their relationship, and it's just, I would say, and as much as I love Lost, I think it's a testament to these newer types of shows that I feel like they have to like hammer things home a lot more, and it's just very heavy-handed in terms of the way it's like, we get it, they have a bad relationship, we get it, and like there are literally points where like he's saying things that I'm like, you don't need to be saying this, like we get it, and it's not like it's not bad. It's actually like it's good television, but it's just different. It's like it's being spoon fed to you. And I really, really appreciate moments like this where it is not spoon fed, but it's enough. It's a teeny tiny moment and your brain can go wild and be like, oh, my God, what led to this? What led to their relationship being like this? Obviously, Samantha. But then what could have gone on there? And then we learn that his parents are actually split up and it's this huge, big deal that they're calling him together. And Mulder's like, he drops everything to go, what's going on with my parents? Like, and I mean, I do love the idea that when it's important, like i.e. Scully or other things, he will drop what he's obsessed with to go take care of business, or I should say personal business. But you're immediately getting this vibe that like, what is going on? This is, there's such a weird dynamic here. And sure enough, the only thing that could possibly have probably put Bill and Tina Mulder in the same house is the apparent return of Samantha.
Yeah. Which is like, boom, that happens like about two thirds of the way through Colony. Up until then, it's just been, you know,
more
typical
aliens.
Kind of mythology stuff, yet more alien stuff and, you know, engaging, of course. And then all of a sudden, you know, I'll never forget that moment.
I was going to ask
Bill Mulder,
your first impressions of the return of Samantha.
I can still remember that moment when Mulder says, you know, who's mom talking to? And Bill Mulder says, your sister. And there's just, I remember, like, there's almost, it feels like there's a pause for just a second on the show for all the audience to gasp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what we all did. I was like, boom, like, oh, shit.
Did you believe
what
it?
What is happening? I did.
Like,
did
were you were fooled throughout this whole episode until what, Endgame? Like, how, I wonder, I'm trying to remember
probably.
When.
Probably. I think, I don't know if I was, like, completely fooled, but I thought there was certainly a very good chance. And, you know, it was early days, and we hadn't been giving this bait and switch Samantha Mulder is back kind of thing, which happens a couple of more times, but this is the first time it happened. And so it was certainly intriguing in the sense that, okay, this does seem like Samantha. This could well be her. Mm-hmm. I think there was maybe a sense that there was something not quite right. It was too good to be true. Because, you know, all of a sudden she's got this really weird story about her parents being aliens and all of that. So it did seem a little weird, but it was gripping. That's for sure. It's like this could really be her.
More of the same in terms of weirdness. So
yeah.
What are you going to do?
But it was like very, very exciting because we hadn't really talked about Samantha that much since sort of early season one, to my recollection. And so to now have her back and, you know, front and center when she's, you know, sort of the raison d'etre for the whole show.
Yeah.
Is, I mean, Jade, like I said, season two is so much. We had the whole Scully abduction and now, holy crap, here's Samantha Mulder. Like, it was just so exciting.
Yeah.
More than anything else, it was just exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. I can imagine that. 'Cause I mean, I don't have a memory of watching this through, but I also, you know, that when I watched these early ones, I was able to sort of binge them. So it wasn't like I could just keep going. I didn't have to wait. And I try to imagine how like that must have felt like at the end of Endgame when she's gone again and you're like, OK, we're going back to this again. We're back at the status quo. Like, I can understand your probably frustration with that. But at the same time, it was a really cool idea to drop her here like this.
Absolutely. It was, and I mean, it just added so much drama. And even though we know as the episode goes on, it wasn't real Samantha, and the characters eventually all know at the same time that we do, essentially.
Yeah.
But that doesn't change how dramatic it is early on, before Mulder finds out the truth. He believes it's Samantha. And so even though her behavior is not authentic, his behavior is, because he believes it's her. Up until he finds out otherwise. And so that will always be an authentic sort of heartfelt experience for Mulder to go through, because he does believe that it's Samantha, without a doubt.
And for us to, and for us to believe as we're watching, especially when it comes to the whole swap, which we'll be talking about shortly. What are your thoughts on Tina Mulder?
To me, in this episode, there's a very clear sort of contrast to me in how Mulder is with his dad and his mom, because everything is so sort of stiff and tense with Bill Mulder. Although, you know, Mulder obviously has affection for him and is seeking affection from him, but doesn't get it. But with Tina Mulder, it's a lot more, it just feels a lot more warm, affectionate.
Yeah.
There is a sense of, and we see this a couple more times through the series, that Mulder feels like he's a little bit of a caretaker for his mom, which is, I can imagine, was perhaps the role he took as a child, which is sort of not a super sort of healthy way to grow up. But I can certainly imagine that happening in that context, you know, where obviously there was a lot of trauma in the family. And, you know, sometimes in those situations, kids feel like they have to be the parents if the parents can't cope. And so there is kind of almost like you get the sense that that might have been their sort of the nature of their relationship. Yeah. But it's very different than the relationship he has with his dad. That's made to me, that feels very clear from the beginning.
Yeah. And I get the feeling too, that as the series progresses, like their relationship becomes more fraught because Mulder learns more. And I feel like a lot of people, I think, give Tina a really bad rap that I don't necessarily agree with. Like, I think that she was put in sort of an impossible position and would have traded anything to not be in that position. And it's interesting to me to watch her reactions to things as opposed to Bill Mulder's, especially when at the end of the day, we really don't know the truth. Like, we don't know who made the decision. Was it Bill? Was it Tina? She said it wasn't, but was it Smoking Man? Like, who was the one who decided it was going to be Samantha? And why is Bill so cold to Mulder? And I mean, there's just so many cool little loose ends to try and tie up and try and make sense of, which I just find so much fun and fascinating.
Yeah.
But
it's a very interesting dynamic.
Yeah. But Tina, like, I feel like once Mulder starts to learn that she knew more than she's let on his entire life, he starts to feel slightly betrayed by her. But at the same time, it's his mom. And I mean, you see that conflict so well in Sein und Zeit when she kills herself. And it's like, he is so frustrated. Like, his arc with his mother is just so tragic to me, because I mean, I can see that, like, she really, really cares, and she's just completely under Smoking Man's thumb at a certain point. And it's just, I don't know, it's upsetting. And I know we're gonna continue to revisit Tina Mulder and Mulder's relationship as we continue, but I just find this a really interesting, like you said, introduction to her character. Like, right now we're just like, oh, she's just the nice mom and she had this tragic past and blah blah, and then later you start to find out, wait, no, she knew. She knew more than we know, and she's been hiding it from Mulder. And, you know, say what you will, but I, like I said, I think she was in an impossible situation.
I always feel, I tend to just feel sorry for her, because I always feel like she, to me, is always presented as a character who had very little agency and was largely a victim of her circumstances. Mm-hmm. And so I've always just felt kind of sorry for her. I mean, I feel like, you know, there's not a lot to admire about her necessarily, because she didn't do anything to stop the things that were going on. And, you know, you could argue about whether she could have at least tried.
To attempt to help Mulder down the road. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's more concerned.
Try to make amends somehow.
Right. About putting it in her past, I feel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So but, you know, I always feel like she's coping the best she can with the horrible hand she was dealt, and obviously has, you know, is carrying a deep trauma in her. And so I always just kind of felt sorry for her more than anything else. Like I said, I don't love her, but I kind of sympathize.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I definitely don't hate her or dislike her. She just kind of, she's just kind of another tragic character. I think just more collateral damage from all of the horribleness that happens.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. And we'll definitely come back to Bill and Tina later.
Yeah.
They're huge parts of the mythology. So.
They we don't realize at this point how big a part in the mythology they're going to play personally.
Right. Right. Before we get into Endgame, I wanted to talk about this cliffhanger with the the shapeshifter. Yeah, the shapeshifter. Mulder, which I think is a really, really great scene. Yeah. But there was one thing that Samantha said, or I should say clone Samantha said to Mulder that I found really cool, and telling him that she's able to tell who the aliens are, you know, just by looking, because she is one, even though they can't tell by looking, which I think was a really cool thing to call back later with Gibson, so to speak, how he was able to tell who was the super soldiers in season 9, and even Jackson to an extent in the revival, who I think had that.
That's right.
I don't think it was established, but I think it can be inferred from some of his behavior in My Struggle For that he can kind of tell who he's talking to when they're not right, you know.
Yeah, he can sense it. Yeah. I don't know why I thought when I was watching Colony and Endgame that there's no reason to believe this, that it was the Samantha clone. She based her perception of who was the alien bounty hunter on the sense of smell. I don't know why I thought that. I just kind of got this idea that she could just smell when he was around.
I think
just
they
because
have...
she seemed to be able to sort of pick it up.
Right. And I think that it's mind reading. I mean, I think
I suppose it's probably, it's like some form of telepathy or something.
Yeah, it's the, because they say that in the end, obviously with Gibson, he's a mind reader and you know he has this alien DNA in him, and then they say it again in Field Trip, even though I know it's a trip sequence, but, you know, Mulder is saying that the aliens communicate telepathically, and I feel like that's brought up several times.
It seems pretty well established.
Yeah, and so I just think that's cool, but they don't spell it out for you here. That's just that's what's so cool. Like you said, like you always just assume she sniffed him or something. But now when you're rewatching, you're like that tracks. That's what's going on. She can telepathically sense him, which I think is really cool.
It's interesting that Mulder doesn't question how she can possibly figure it out so readily. I mean, obviously, from his perspective, she's had experience with these aliens because she was adopted by them. And I guess he just kind of figures, well, she's just hung out with enough aliens that she can figure this out. But that probably should have been a little bit of a red flag to him that she seems awfully clever when it comes to identifying the ABH. And it's like, something doesn't quite add up here. But he's clearly in a willing suspension of disbelief at that point, I think.
Well, I think, his blinders are on for a moment because he's very concerned about Scully, which we can all forget.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's also obviously a storytelling device because we don't want her to explain that. Chris Carter doesn't want her to explain that. So,
and I think it does work sort of from a character's perspective that, you know, maybe Mulder just wants to believe so badly that this is Samantha that he's not going to question it. And
and
he's not going to be as skeptical as he normally would be.
Right.
So it makes sense.
And we see, like you said, we see that time and time again. Whenever it comes to Samantha, all of his preconceived, like any of that just falls away. And he's like,
he'll believe anything at that point.
Absolutely anything.
And Scully that always has to try to step in and wisen him up.
Yes. Anyway, I had to point that out because I enjoy any type of mythology continuity. That's what we're here to point out for
you
folks.
That's what we're here for.
Love it. So Scully is meanwhile, and I love the idea that like Scully is trying desperately to reach Mulder, and we know the only reason that he can't be there instantly to protect her is because he's dealing with this family emergency, which I think again is very brilliant plotting. Well done. Because he's not available. And we also know that his phone got broken when he got hit by the car.
I had completely forgotten that he got hit by the car. I was watching. It's been a while since I've watched these two for some reason.
Every time I watch this, I think that.
Yeah, I always gasp.
Yes.
I'm like, I think I actually, I was watching this on my iPad in my bedroom, like, late at night, and I was like, no! It's not like I've never seen it before, because there's something about the way they shoot that that is, like, so shocking.
Well, and Mulder literally is like Superman. He's like, I got the wind. It's essentially like I got the wind knocked out of me moment. He literally got hit by a car. Yeah. And then the next day he's like, I'm good, you know, I'm all right. And I'm just like, wow, Mulder. We know Mulder is tough, but I think that's probably the reason why I always forget about this, because he doesn't really seem to suffer any effects from it.
Consequences. The only consequences are his phone.
Yeah, his poor phone. R.I.P. Mulder's cell phone.
Yeah, let's hope that he got a smaller and better one, because it was pretty gigantic at that point.
Yeah, but I think By Endgame, he has a new phone. So
yes.
he got he got he, he got that taken care of.
He can't be without a phone for long. It's illustrated for him vividly what happens when he doesn't have a cell phone on him.
Dolly
gets into trouble.
She does, and he can't reach her. And I mean, I love whenever Scully can't get a hold of Mulder or whatever. Like, and she instantly gets super paranoid. Like, I really like those little moments where it's like, wait, Mulder's not around. What do I do? I have forgotten who I am, and I'm suddenly paranoid. Yeah, and so she's like,
paranoid.
Yeah, I mean, she is being followed, so she's a right to be paranoid. But like, I love, by the way, seeing again Scully casual clothes alert. Like, she's jogging with her pony and like trying to catch the bus and heading to Germantown and like snooping around in warehouses and seeing alien babies and just forgetting that she saw them as usual.
It's great. She just goes off and she becomes, you know, super X-File agent all by herself. And I just have to point out briefly on a personal note, shout out to the fact that the name of the street that the warehouse is on is Edmonton Street, because Edmonton happens to be the name of my hometown.
So I was. It sounded familiar.
And I think there probably is an Edmonton Street in Vancouver, so I suspect that's probably where they got the name from. But I'm just excited because, you know,
take it. Edmonton, a shout out to you.
Edmonton doesn't get a lot of shout outs in popular culture, so I gotta really enjoy it when it happens.
I love it. It reminded me also of the same sort of warehouse type in Erlenmeyer Flask, where, you know, Mulder found all that crazy shit and then it just kind of immediately got removed, which seems kind of like what's going on here in a way. But like, Scully literally sees stuff. Like, she goes in there and she sees alien fetuses. And I mean, I suspect, just like the alien fetus that she saw in Erlenmeyer Flask, she can sort of suspend her disbelief because that's what Scully does, and kind of try and come up with another thing that she saw. Like, okay, this isn't just because they're experimenting with fetal tissue doesn't necessarily mean that it's an alien. Like, I mean, I can see how her brain may not jump to that. Like, okay, this is what I'm going to believe. If it were Mulder, he would instantly believe it.
Yes, but without a second thought.
While we can kind of laugh and make fun of it, I guess I'm allowing Scully this. I'm allowing her skepticism in this moment, even though I do find it funny.
It is a little funny.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that it's a coping mechanism. I mean, that's one of the things that I find so interesting about Scully's journey, is that she is kind of at sea in an ocean of really scary stuff that completely rocks her worldview from the moment she walks into the X-Files office in the pilot. And she's all in. She's not, you know, trying to distance herself from it in any way, shape or form. And she has Mulder there as her guide, as best as he can be one for her, being so different from her. But a lot of her character arc is about her journey through these scary, distressing, sort of worldview altering experiences. And, you know, it makes total sense to me that as like a coping mechanism, some things she just can't get her head around.
Right.
And it's like, okay, we're going to pretend that didn't happen. Because, I mean, we all do that as human beings. When something happens that, you know, brings about some cognitive dissonance, that's sort of the classic way to cope with cognitive dissonance. If things don't match in your head, one of them has to go. And so I'm just going to pretend that didn't happen. I think that works.
Yeah, even if that thing happens to be the truth. I find that really fascinating. And again, I love the parallel to season 8, Scully wandering around in that room full of baby jars. Like, you know what I mean? With the alien babies. The room full of baby jars. And she's pregnant at the moment. And so I can completely see her, like you said, like repressing that or like burying it, going, no, there is no way that this is actually a thing that's happening to me. Because when it's happening to you, it's really easy. Like the Samantha thing we were just talking about with Mulder, it's really easy to suddenly flip and say, no, now that it's happening to me, no, that's not okay. And so I really enjoy, I mean, a lot of the season 8 Scully belief stuff I find super compelling, but like that in particular, when it comes to like her own body and her own pregnancy and her own and like William and everything, I feel like it's really interesting to see and make more sense of as a viewer her denial of that. So I appreciate that, and I appreciate the parallel. So Scully gets to, what is it, I wrote down the name of the Motor Court. It was like Valley Village Motor Court.
Oh,
it was
yeah.
Like, I don't know. It was like...
Yeah. Village...
Something like that.
Village... Yeah, something. It was a very generic sounding motel.
Something very happy sounding. But there are no happy things happening.
Vacation Village. That's
Vacation
what it was,
Village. She's on a vacation. Yeah.
She's on a vacation. Honestly, though, the Vacation Village motor inn doesn't really look like a fun vacation place for anyone.
No, it doesn't.
That's just slightly seedy place where you just sort of, you know... have a little, maybe a rendezvous perchance, mm-hmm. or just a place to sleep for the night.
Yeah, yeah. I like to think maybe they do that later at some point. We can talk about that on a different podcast.
Yeah, okay.
But we have the alien bounder show up as Mulder. And it's really cool. It's a really cool cliffhanger. I think this is probably one of those cliffhangers I think people maybe forget because it is kind of like buried in the middle of this. It's not like a series or a season cliffhanger, but it's a really good one. And she's, you know, it's right. It's that like you're on the phone, but you're here. But what am I gonna do? And like, you know, anytime you get that to be continued, it's always super exciting.
So great. I love that cliffhanger. That's probably one of my favorite cliffhangers because it's just so what the fuck.
Yeah.
It's just really well done and just everything about it is like, how is she gonna get out of this one? And just that moment, because we realize at the same time that Scully does as viewers, that's not really Mulder.
Right.
And so it's like shocking to us at the same time that it's shocking to her. So it's so great.
And to Scully's credit, I mean, especially considering later that she does sort of fall for this gotcha, like twice. I think maybe the sensation of danger and paranoia helps and plays into this. But she, to her credit, she knows right away something's wrong. Like, she trusts that Mulder on the phone is the real Mulder. And
she
that does. This, whoever this is not Mulder. And she's face-to-face with an actual shapeshifter. Yet another thing Scully gets to see happen in front of her eyes. And Mulder, and what a cool scene that they would have got to have filmed, like gets to shove her up against the wall and like throw her into a coffee table, and like they have this really cool like sort of fight. It's not really a fight because Scully loses, but it's that happens at the beginning of Endgame, but we can go into that actually.
But I mean, there are so many of these sort of physical confrontations that Mulder and Scully have throughout the series individually. And so Gillian and David have to play these fight scenes regularly with, of course, the able assistance of their stunt doubles. So it must have been kind of fun and different to actually have a fight scene with each other.
Yeah, I think that would have been super fun for them. And looks kind of painful to get thrown into a glass coffee table.
Ouch.
Although I will say I have not personally fallen into a glass coffee table, but my sister has.
Let's just say that is not a pleasant experience.
Let's just say it was a house party while my parents were away. We were not supposed to be doing this. And we had, I'm going to tell this story. This was a ghetto old like 80s coffee table with tinted glass that was like very, very difficult to find. Okay, we literally spent the entire next day going to glass stores all around our hometown or our town, finding this glass, paying for them to get it cut and fixed to fit this ugly ass coffee table before our parents returned. Let me tell you, Jen, they did not find out until like 5 years later. They didn't find out. We kept that secret from them. And when my dad finally learned, he said, you know, I don't know whether to be pissed or impressed. Like, and for the record, he was impressed.
But my question, though, your sister fell into the glass coffee table. Obviously, the coffee table didn't fare well. But was your sister not injured in some fashion?
No, she was injured. But we had had a lot of alcohol, Jen. So she
just kept on going.
She wanted to keep on going, but it was pretty funny because she actually got up and I have to tell because it was so funny. She got up. She was so drunk that she just screamed at the entire party, "Everybody get the fuck out of my house." And everyone was like, "Okay, party's over." And everybody left. We take her into the bathroom. We're cleaning her up. And she definitely had gotten cut, but luckily it was not bad. She was very lucky. So we got her cleaned up. She was okay. And then she came out and I swear to God, she was so confused. She was like, "Where did everybody go? We were having a party." And we were like, You kicked them out, dude. And it was just, it was quite a weekend, Jen, let me tell you. Those were the good old times. And these were during my X-Files times, I must say. So I actually brought the story back around to X-Files because this was the era of my life in which I was being introduced to the X-Files. So there we go.
You were living the crashing into a glass coffee table lifestyle during X-Files time.
Probably when I was watching this episode.
Yeah, whereas I was already married and working full time and not really living the crashing into
your
the
coffee
glass
table
top.
Crashing days were over by then.
They were kind of over at that point for the most part. Not entirely looking back on it, but for the most part, I was. That's why I had to watch all the crazy shit on the X-Files, because I needed a little excitement in my life.
Well, though, to answer your question, I don't know how it feels to fall through a coffee table, but my sister does, and I will definitely have to ask her. But she also wasn't being shoved in by an alien bounty hunter.
That was from a height as well. Yeah, that Scully fell into that table.
It was literally up against the wall, thrown down into the coffee table where my sister was just dancing on it and fell through it. That's what happened. It was not a weekend full of good decisions. I am admitting that. Okay. These were bad decisions being made.
I feel bad for laughing because she was hurt, but it's just a very funny story.
It was a good story. I still love telling that story. So thank you. I'm glad I got to tell it to all of the listeners.
Great story.
Oh, geez. Well, anyway, we love to digress on this podcast.
Last table.
Okay. After Scully was at Vacation Village, thrown into a coffee table. So I'm trying to remember, actually, I completely blanked, even though I watched this last night. Did he just run out of the room? And how did she get out of this? I'm trying to remember.
I don't think we see it. I don't think we actually see the literal end of that scene. I think it's just
because he takes her, obviously, and then we see her in the payphone booth, I think.
Yeah,
so.
I think it just kind of ends with her obviously disabled to some degree, right, and you know, and ABH turning back into ABH and sort of looming over her. I think that's the last.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Yeah, the last shot.
So we're sort of left with the impression that either she's about to be murdered, or as we soon find out, she was in fact abducted again.
Yes, kidnapped. And then, you know, Mulder is going to lose his shit, which we always enjoy.
Always. I love me some Mulder losing his shit over abducted Scully. It happens a lot and I love it every time.
Yeah, yeah, love it. So he goes to, we have a Skinner scene,
We do. Skinner's in both of these parts a fair bit. He has a couple of noteworthy scenes.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember because I'm getting all muffled.
We have this, Mulder has to go and find out that Scully's missing, and then he has the meeting with Skinner in his apartment after that.
Right.
Couple of meetings in.
Well, that was earlier because he thought that Skinner might be an alien bounty hunter, and then they found out essentially that Scully had been kidnapped. Yes. And what I find really. Yeah, what I found was interesting about this whole arc, this whole plot, at least from Scully's perspective, is that, like, she does not know that it's Samantha who is the one, or quote-unquote Samantha, that Mulder has. It's like, she doesn't know, and he kind of doesn't want her to know, but at the same time, like, you can see him sort of struggling over this decision, but in the end, like, Samantha gives him, like, permission, essentially. Yeah. Like, just no, let him have me. And I wonder how much of that is, like, she knows she's expendable, or it's just, she knows, it doesn't really matter if I live, because you're going to find this note, and you're going to go to where you need to go. You're maneuverable, like she says. Yeah. And I want to say that, like, part of me wants to believe, that clone Samantha is, like, somewhat trying to be helpful and trying to, like, keep his partner from getting killed, which I think is possible. Like, what do you think in terms of her motivations to be like, do this switch? It's okay. Yeah. Do this switch. What do you think about that?
I think I find clone Samantha very appealing, I have to say. I think maybe part of that is the actress. It just has a very appealing way about her for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe I have a tiny crush on her. I'm not really sure now, but maybe. And she is... She does have a very sympathetic demeanor, and it does seem very genuine. And when Scully goes missing, like when Mulder arrives at the vacation village and is in the room when I always think that's a really cool shot where Mulder's holding sort of the lamp with sort of the naked light bulb. It's just very cool lighting.
Yeah.
Samantha, clone Samantha, is right there and seems like super like supportive and helpful. And she's with him while he's waiting for the call. She tells him, you know, he's going to call. And yeah, I mean, I suppose for a lot of that is because she just needs to keep him on side. But it always does kind of feel genuine to me as well. She just seems like kind of a nice person.
The reason I ask is that I wonder if it's possible through the cloning that maybe there is some sort of embedded Samantha-ness that responds to his distress, you know, like that is she sees how he's reacting to his lost partner and she's trying to like ease him, you know, in a way. Like I like to think that even if that's not intended, I think it could be possible. This is the X-Files. I don't know. I just like to believe that.
Yeah. I think that's certainly a valid headcanon, I would say, that's a good explanation. I think she is generally, she and the Gregors are kind of presented, I think, as sort of worthy of protection throughout these episodes. And I think we are meant to be somewhat sympathetic. So I think they do make her character kind of appealing and kind of sympathetic. And Mulder, God knows, Mulder needs a little support when Scully's abducted. So I'm glad he had it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, my next question, since we're talking about Samantha, and then we'll talk about the swap in a minute. But like, in terms of her actual cloning, like how they cloned her and how the experiments worked, did you wrap your mind around this yet? Because I was trying to figure out, like, if they took her at age 8 and mm-hmm. cloned her at that age, and then she was essentially, say she grew at the same rate we grow, then mm-hmm. she would be that age. Like, that would be the age that clone would be. But then we later learn in season 4, Herrenvoke, when we meet the younger Samantha clones, that I'm guessing these are, like, a different type of clone that maybe were made from ova. Like, were made from, they were made from ova, you know, which makes sense because they had the ova from Samantha whenever they abducted her. And they were probably doing all kinds of experiments. We see that there are, like, hundreds of them. So what I'm saying is I feel like these are two different types of experiments that we're seeing that is all coming from the same sort of Samantha DNA that they had taken from her original abduction.
There's definitely at least like I would say like more than one batch. And I don't really have a theory yet about where those batches come from. I haven't watched Herrenvoke in a long time. Yeah. So I will develop a theory when we get to that.
I just wanted to bring that up because I feel like that's the only other time we see the clones and they're a different age. So it's just worth thinking about. It's worth thinking about.
Yeah, something to keep an eye on as we go through the mythology.
Sort of maybe the same way they make Emily, like our kids like Emily. Like they obviously start as babies and then they grow. Mm-hmm. By the time we get to them, they're at that certain age. So I don't know. I find that interesting just to think about. Yeah. The actual mechanics.
She certainly is the right age, though, you're right, for what, you know, real Samantha would have been.
Right. So maybe the experiment sort of like evolved from.
Yeah,
who knows? This swap, I want to hear your thoughts on the MSR going on here, the heavy MSR feels.
Yeah, for the swap.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting, it's such an interesting sort of dilemma, of course, for Mulder. You know, Scully or Samantha, who do you value kind of thing. And it's, you know, the MSR fan in me just wants to kind of say, he loves Scully best because he was willing to swap Samantha for her. And I don't think it's quite that simple.
No.
I think that Mulder was very convinced that he could pull this off with no one getting hurt, which is a classic sort of Mulder sort of belief, I think. Mulder always wants to think that no one's going to get hurt. And he had good reason for that. I mean, he had Skinner on side. He had the FBI supporting him. I'm guessing that this was their sort of setup and their tactics. And obviously they convinced him that this would work. And so I think he never really believed that Samantha was genuinely at risk, although he had to know there was some risk to her.
Yeah.
So he was obviously willing to take a chance on her safety. To get Scully back. But I don't think he certainly didn't think it was going to be a swap. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's actually a good point. And then because you see his demeanor change significantly once Samantha's actually taken away. And it's almost like she doesn't, he doesn't really want Scully to know even then, because like he gets it. Like he gets that like she is going to feel guilty. He would feel guilty if he had decided not to do this, which I don't think, like you said, he would ever have made that decision. But like, again, then after this is over, he has to go tell his father. And so he's thinking of all of this. He's like, you know, on one hand, he can't even really be relieved or happy that he has Scully back because of all of this other crap that's going on, you know, even though at the end of the day, he knows he made the right decision, which is essentially what he says to his father, which I like that at least he says that. Yeah. That scene just kills me because Bill Mulder, oh my God, he is one to talk. Like you.
Yeah. I mean, knowing what we know about him later on, it's like, dude, how dare you?
Right. Like, he literally says like, you gave up your sister. Like, bitch, what did you do? Like, and again, like I said, we don't know the whole story, but as far as Bill's concerned, I just think that's a little rich coming from him.
It's very rich.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's another subject that I want to discuss at some point tonight as well, which is what does Bill Mulder know at this point about Samantha? And was he in a position to know that this wasn't real Samantha all along?
Yeah.
And was he just pretending that it was? Because he doesn't seem to be too excited about her return. Mom is obviously excited about it, but Dad doesn't seem too excited. So I do wonder, looking back on it, what did he really know about Samantha's fate? And does he know from the beginning this can't really be her?
Well, and I think obviously he had to know about the cloning experience. Like he was part of the syndicate. He had to know what their plans were for these people. I mean, in theory, they were all supposed to be kept safe and then returned. That was the idea. And so maybe at one point he thought maybe this is her return, but he was also very skeptical. And then at a certain point also, he can't rip her from Tina again. Right. Yeah. Like he isn't going to be the one to be like, this isn't her. And so there's that aspect to sort of think about, too. And I mean, I'm not like trying to side with Bill Mulder in any way, shape or form, but I'm just kind of trying to understand his behavior. Like you said, like,
oh, absolutely.
How much does he know? Since we know the truth of what happened to Samantha at this point, we know that like, obviously that's not her, but like does Bill Mulder know that she died in 89 or whatever? Is he aware of
exactly.
that? Yeah.
And is he just kind of playing along? I mean, I can certainly understand why he wouldn't tell the truth at that point, because, you know, really what good would it do? But so I can understand his behavior, you know, play along with it. But then if he knew that it wasn't real Samantha, to then go to Mulder and lay a guilt trip on him about, you know, you've lost your sister,
right,
and you know what this is going to do to your mother kind of thing. That's a low blow if he knew for a fact that that wasn't her.
In a way, it feels almost like he's unloading all of his own bullshit and like his own guilt onto Mulder, almost like he's transferring it. Like, you know what, if I can put this on you, it will somehow absolve me of all the sins of my past, which I think is interesting. And I feel like we get a little bit of redemption for him in Anasazi, which we'll talk about next episode of this. Just not redemption, but a little bit more understanding, I guess I should say.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, and that did cross my mind. So to answer your question, I don't really know what he knows, but it is interesting to think about and to wonder. I bet there are lots of possibilities.
It's an interesting question, and it definitely sort of shades his behavior depending on how much he knows. But, you know, it's one of those things we can theorize about. So it's very, and I think that's a really good point you make about how, you know, he could well be unloading all of his own guilt onto Mulder, because even the things he says are very much the kind of things, you know, about what it did to Tina Mulder and, you know, losing Samantha and all of those things, and the choice, the decision being made. Did you make this decision? This is all very much, he could be talking to himself. And again, sort of, you know, classic kind of projection behavior. The thing that we hate most in ourselves is what we perceive in others.
Yeah.
And so I think that makes total sense. Obviously, we would not have thought of it that way at the time. He just seemed like kind of an uptight jerk.
Yeah.
But now looking back on it, it makes total sense that it was just him kind of like projecting his own guilt onto Mulder, which makes, you know, I can see it totally.
Yeah. And I mean, also, probably at this point, he feels like, what have I got to lose? Like, we don't have a relationship. You know, it's like, let's just make him feel like shit. And then maybe I'll feel a little bit better about it. Yeah. It's really
and
sad.
Mulder, and Mulder just takes it. So you can kind of get a sense that this is how their relationship has been.
My heart.
And it's just, it's kind of, it's sadly not an uncommon kind of dynamic, I think, where a parent is a shit parent and treats the kid in a crap way, but the kid just kind of assumes they deserve it on some level and just kind of takes it.
Yeah.
And so that's what's heartbreaking. If that had turned into like a big argument and Mulder had been like, it's not my fault, or had defended himself in some fashion, then it wouldn't be nearly as sort of emotional as it is with Bill Mulder, you know, being angry and laying blame, and Mulder just taking all of that on and being heartbroken about it. It breaks our hearts too.
Yeah, and just again, just a brilliant scene acting by David, and just so much information you can get out of that from him as a character. Just the idea, I mean, you know, go on and on and on about Mulder and like his problematic issues with like maybe not feeling like he's deserving of love. Like, and I think that is just like really kind of sad and interesting because you see it, like he doesn't form relationships. He said it at the opening monologue. It's like, or the relationships that he has formed have failed, which we also find out, you know, as the show goes along, that he isn't able to sort of maintain these relationships. And so it makes sense too why he would keep Scully at arm's length, so to speak, in a certain way. Anyway, it really tracks and it kind of breaks my heart and I kind of hate it, but it's sad.
But, and it does kind of explain a lot about, because, you know, obviously Mulder and Scully, that you have to come up with some kind of an explanation for, you know, like you say, why he keeps her at arm's length to a certain point.
They both do, to be fair.
And they both do, certainly. And so this is kind of a good insight into why Mulder might do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the ways in which he has been screwed up by his upbringing and how that influences, you know, why his relationships are, you know, never really particularly fulfilling or functional for him. So this explains it in a lot of ways because, you know, obviously he brings that into his relationship with Scully and it explains a lot from his perspective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we get a visit from X. And when was the last time we saw X? Was it One Breath? I think.
Yes, I believe it was.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And he does not. I love X. He's so different than Deep Throat because it's like he just does not want to be there. He's like, I don't want to help. I love his line when he's like, how was the opera? Right. Wonderful. I've never slept better.
Yeah.
It's like, you can be funny. Right. Yeah. I was like, okay.
Yeah, he is quite sort of, he's funny in a very snarky way. And I love that.
Yeah. The fat lady is singing. I don't know. I just like, he speaks very cryptically.
So blunt. Yeah. Yeah. And the way he says, you know, they're all dead. It's like, whoa, yeah. It's like, he doesn't sugarcoat things. I love that about him.
You know what I love about X, too? He is the king of being like, fuck you, I'm not going to help you. Cut away. And then we find out that he's helped. Like, I love that so much about him. It's like, he does not want to, but he's like, well, I guess so. Again, that's what happens here. Like, Mulder's like, I got to get out there. And he's like, no, you don't. You really don't. Yeah. There's nothing out there. Which we kind of find out that at the end, Mulder probably shouldn't have gone out there, but it did help him, I suppose. But he goes out there anyway on X's information. So we have a scenario here of X actually giving him quite helpful information, and then we have Scully following. We have a Mulder ditch here essentially.
But then we have
X not helping Scully, but then, like, does he really get beat up by Skinner, or does he just
Skinner definitely gets beat up. We know that.
Yeah, it's like, I feel like, this is what I'm saying, is like, I feel like X has the upper hand in that fight, but yet we still, Skinner still gets the information out of him.
I totally agree. I mean, it is kind of presented as, you know, Skinner beats it out of him, but I think the moment in their sort of encounter where X changes his mind about whether he's going to help or not is when Skinner says something like, you know, you could shoot me, but you'll be killing two men. And I think that's when X is like, okay, fine. And I think that's probably when Skinner gets the information. I'm always a little disappointed that Scully wasn't able to elicit the information from X, just because I would have liked to see her have, you know, kicking some ass with the informants occasionally, because she rarely gets a chance to do that.
Oh, but she has a great scene with X in Herringvoke, so.
Yeah, there are good things to come.
Yes,
but,
yeah.
I kind of wanted to see more of them together, actually, and for her to actually, you know, be able to get that information for herself from X instead of Skinner having to intervene for her, essentially. But, you know, it's all good. She gets the information and she kicks ass with that information.
Yeah. And part of me thinks, like, again, when I enter into my headcanon, that like X is sort of secretly a softie for Scully, and maybe he gives in because he's like, that face. She was so sad. Like, she was so sad. Like, she was almost crying. I was like, no, Scully, no.
She's so sad. Scully is very emotional throughout this whole two-parter.
Yeah.
And Jillian is bringing it. I love it. So yeah. She's so great in these episodes. It's just so terrific for me. So, yeah. I think it's entirely possible that X meets Scully and immediately falls in love with her and is like, yeah, no, I can't let that beautiful lady down.
Yeah.
She's too beautiful and sad.
She's too, that sad, beautiful lady. I need to help her find her man. even though he's like, Mulder, I can give a shit about, but we gotta help him for Scully.
I think that's entirely possible.
I love that.
I'm gonna keep an eye open for some ex Scully fanfic now.
Yeah, is he kind of shipping it, or is he just is enamored of Scully? Maybe.
Yeah, it could be a little of both. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but there could be some interesting pining going on there. I'm curious to find out.
I like how we just completely made that up out of whole cloth, and we are so into it.
It feels right to me.
Yeah, I love it. So Scully ends up going to Alaska, right? Which is funny because, again, we don't really give this a lot of attention. The fact that she goes all the way to Alaska to save Mulder's life, and Mulder does go all the way to Antarctica to save her life later. But they're always going to like the other end of the world to save each other, like all the time. And I mean, these two, my God, just admit it. Guys, like, come on. No,
I mean, even just within this two-parter, they're saving each other's life up and down the yin yang. I mean, when Skinner says to Scully, you know, he's endangered your life, and Scully cannot say fast enough, he saved my life.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then she saves his.
Then
so
she
it's
saves
like,
his. I love this sort of tit for tat sort of like, he, you know, we are always going to be there for each other. And this two-parter is just full of that. I love it.
Yeah, it really is. I adore that.
Yeah. Let's go back to Mulder, because he's at this submarine, I guess. Where the craft, I guess, crashed. But there's a submarine also.
The submarine was on its way to encounter.
They were
the
looking
craft,
for
I
it,
guess.
Right? Like,
yeah,
I feel
they,
like, yeah, they.
They
saw
came
something,
it.
And then
yeah,
we're like, let's go check
it,
that
and
out.
And then the last we saw, they were plotting a course to head for it.
Right.
And for whatever reason, the alien bounty hunter decided that submarine was going to be the best way of getting back to his craft.
Yeah.
Which I guess makes some sense. The submarine would come in handy for that.
It would. To go, you know, it's sunk. So.
Yeah. So he's going to get it. He's just decided to take the submarine and go and do what he needs to do. And so Mulder comes upon the submarine while the alien bounty hunter is on board.
Exactly. And I wanted to ask.
I was just going to say, how great is that shot of submarine, you know, surfacing
or the ship
through
or
the ice?
Through the ice. Yeah, that's so cool.
So great.
Yeah.
That's just iconic.
Totally iconic. Enjoy that a lot. It's when I think of Colony Endgame, that's the image that comes to my mind.
Me
so.
Too. It's all I can remember sometimes.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Granted, at this point in the mythology, it's possible that the 1013 company was not entirely certain what they were going to do with the Samantha Ark. Let's all stipulate that. Do you think that the alien bounty hunter telling Mulder she's alive, is he lying or is he just misinformed? Or is he just like fucking with Mulder? Now looking back, what would your headcanon be?
It's a very good question, and certainly one that I was asking myself, too. I don't know if I know yet what my theory is on that, but there's no reason for him to mislead Mulder because he believes that he's about to kill Mulder. So I don't see why he would lie to him at that point, unless it's like to make him feel better before he dies, which I don't see why he would do that.
Right.
So I'm inclined to think he was misinformed.
Okay.
I think that's the best explanation, because it seems like he's pretty sincere about it. And like I say, I don't see a reason for him to lie at that stage. I mean, at the time, of course, as viewers, we believed that it was the truth, because he seemed pretty sincere in the circumstances in which he told it. So in lieu of it being the truth, which, of course, now we know it's not, the best I can come up with is that he believed that it was the truth.
Yeah, or it's possible that he thinks he doesn't know Mulder's history with his sister. He thinks that Mulder is referring to this woman that I kidnapped and that fell off the bridge, and he thinks that she's still alive because he thinks, oh, well, she's like me. She probably got out of the lake and took off running. So it's possible that he's not giving Mulder this heavy, weighty information that Mulder is taking it as. It's possible that he just thinks Mulder's talking about, or he thinks that, Mulder's referring to just the clone Samantha, that woman must be your sister. Because, I mean, I don't know how much the alien bounty hunter knows.
Yeah, he doesn't barely keep track of everyone's personal life.
Right, so maybe he is giving Mulder a correct statement. He believes she's probably alive, because maybe last he saw her, she was alive. I don't know. Yeah. But Mulder is taking it as, oh my God, my sister's alive. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so my real sister. And he knows this for a fact, and he's in a position to know this and to relate this information to me.
Right. When maybe he's not. Like you're saying, it's kind of a mix up or an amalgamation between being misinformed and actually thinking that he's telling the truth, you know? Yeah. So
I think that's a good theory. I like that one.
All right, I'll take it, because it kind of works and it makes me not want to hit my head against the wall. Yeah. So I'll take it.
Headcanon accepted.
Yeah, yeah. So Mulder, of course, is rescued then by Scully, who it must be said, whenever Scully, and I love the way they open Colony with this, because you right away you're in media res, you're like, okay, wait, Mulder's dying? What happened? And then,
what is happening?
And they don't do that a whole lot. I feel like they kind of try to do that a little bit in Tunguska Terma. Like, they do that a little bit. But I really like that method of...
Yeah. I like that. What do you call that again? In media res.
In media res,
called, right? Like, when you start in the middle of the story, basically.
Exactly, yeah. And I love that anytime Scully gets to come be a badass and save Mulder's life, it's definitely worth pointing out. And she does here. And she... Again, another thing that's worth pointing out, and if you listen to all of her voiceover when she's sort of describing what she's doing, what she's actually doing to cure him, is very, very much in line with later in Dead Alive, season 8, what she does to cure Mulder. Mm-hmm. And it's similar. Yep. It's all very similar, the idea of the virus laying dormant. He's dead, but he's not really dead. It's just this virus that's just in there keeping him alive in a way. And they use the word retrovirus, they use the word antivirals. Like, this is all stuff that comes back later. And again, Dead Alive is another Frank Spotnitz. So, anyway, I just think that that's amazing. And anytime they can kind of track with the alien, with the continuity and the alien mythology, I love pointing that out. And also, speaking of Dead Alive, I don't think I ever really made the intense connection between these scenes being so similar in terms of him being frozen or dead, essentially near dead, her vigil at his bedside, which I know you love, and literally him waking up and her saying hi or hey. It's the same thing as Dead Alive. It's the same thing. It's such a beautiful parallel, and I am such a whore for that. I love it. I love it.
I totally agree. I hadn't noticed that myself until I was watching again this week, because I watched Dead Alive and Endgame so far apart that I never made the connection at the time. But watching it now, I was like, I'm getting such a Dead Alive vibe from this. And then I realized, there's a reason for that. There are genuine sort of parallels here.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I love that scene in Dead Alive. And so, and I love this scene too. So it's, very interesting parallels for sure. And both fantastic scenes.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to bring that up, because again, it's not a connection that I think I would have made. So I just found it really interesting to think about.
It's great.
But I mean, that's all I have on my notes, unless you had anything else you wanted to talk about for Endgame.
I find it interesting that there's this whole sort of theme at the end there about faith being tested and then sort of like regaining that faith for both Scully and Mulder. For me personally, I feel like it works slightly better for Scully in the context of these episodes that her faith in science has indeed been tested. We see that for ourselves. And, you know, she has her sort of monologue at the end talking about how, you know, she has regained her faith in science because science saved Agent Mulder's life. In what I can recall specifically, my husband and I referring to her speech as the hooray for science speech, mm-hmm. because she says the word science so much in yeah. that speech because she's just crazy about science. So that to me makes sense in the arc of her character within this two-parter, that, you know, she's fallen in love with science all over again. That's wonderful. And expected. And then we also see Mulder saying, you know, when he regains consciousness, he says, I found something I thought I'd lost, faith to keep looking, which is, you know, a very sort of, you know, very X-Files theme. We see that numerous times. I don't know personally. I'm not sure how well it tracks within this particular two-parter. I'm not sure I'm getting where he lost the faith to keep looking, because he seems to have pretty strong faith to keep looking throughout these episodes. And, you know, he's talking about the fact that this quest has lost him so much. So there's no indication to me that he's ever questioned the quest, unless it was, I guess there's a tiny hint that he never really had solid proof before, and now he has that. But I'm not sure if I totally get this idea that he was ever lacking in that faith.
I see what you're saying. I feel like you're kind of trying to push it beyond this episode, and I feel like he's just referring to within this episode, because there's like that moment when he finds out they're all clones, and he's like truly brokenhearted. Mm. Like he looks gutted. Like I have lost her again, and then probably his entire journey up there is this horrible doubt gnawing at him. And so I feel like maybe that's what he's referring to.
Yeah, I think that's that's a good point, actually, because you're right. I mean, that moment when he finds out, especially, you know, those Samanthas are pretty blunt about it. When the clones say, you know,
we
knew you could be manipulated, you know, it's like, ouch.
The other Samantha was way better.
She was way nicer. They're a little bit mean. And so I think you're probably right. I think I'm probably looking for more than we're given, but that's enough that, you know, within, you know, it wasn't like a lengthy loss of faith, but, you know, just in the last couple of days, that's long enough when it's something really traumatic like that. So it probably does refer more to just, you know, it was a blow, definitely, when not only to find out that it wasn't really Samantha, but also to find out that they were just using him and that he could be used. And it's a pretty rough experience. So I can see that it's a nice sort of closure on that experience to kind of feel like, okay, it was harsh, but I'm not done and that's not going to stop me. So I can see that now. And I think it's a nice sort of parallel at the end where both Scully and Mulder have regained their own faith in their own things.
Right.
Scully in science, Mulder in his quest.
It's like every time
and
we
so
kind of
really like that.
Yeah, every time we kind of come back around and we kind of, in a way it's like everyone we reboot. Like we're back to where we were. Even they've gone all through all this stuff, but their relationship has progressed. Like they have developed more trust in each other, and they have banked more hours into caring for one another and actually like accepting each other for who they are, which I think is just that no matter what is going to progress their relationship. But I like the idea that, like you said, Mulder has sort of they deal with it in a different way, like in season 5, the idea that he loses his faith a little bit and then it spans several episodes.
Yeah, but that's a much bigger event.
Yeah, you can see it, though. Like, you can see it happening. And I find that to be such a... They had to do that, though, because they wanted Scully to kind of go the other way. And it's like, okay, let's do our two ships passing in the night thing. And then, and that made that entire mythology arc really interesting. Here, I really think that they're just kind of trying to keep this contained into this two-parter.
Yeah.
So but I like what you said earlier about Scully kind of it's almost like she's grounded herself again. Like she needed this experience to recalibrate and be like, you're right. This is where all my faith needs to be going is here, because I can see it working in front of my eyes. Like here he is. He's alive. It worked. And I can just forget that alien fetus that I saw in the warehouse because it's gone now. So
it's gone now. And
I can't see it. I can't hear
handy.
It. It doesn't exist. Yeah.
Hooray for science.
Yes.
And so, yeah, she's right back on the science train. And that's fine. I mean, like you say, we do kind of wind up in a reset at the end of these episodes, which on the surface, I usually hate that sort of thing in television where it's like, oh, so like none of this really happened. But it's just worked so well for me. And in terms of how the characters are, and this is an ongoing theme, the search for faith and losing and regaining faith that happens throughout the series. And it's an interesting and compelling theme for the characters. And so, you know, to sort of regain their faith, it doesn't feel so much like a reset so much as a sort of a deepening of who they are. And so it doesn't feel like they're back to where they are. It's just, you know, we haven't quite lost them.
Like,
there's another, there's just a few more layers added on.
Right. And I mean, yeah, like I said, it's baby steps, but it's progressing. And I mean, you do get, as the mythology continues and even as the show continues, you do get Mulder saying things like, after all you've seen, she says, after all I've seen, like they are acknowledging that these things have happened. It's just like every single time, like you said, even in the Monster of the Weeks, there's always a reset, like the monster gets away or like they're back to the beginning. Like that's just the nature of the show. And I think that keeps you watching. So
they pull it off. Like some shows that annoys me, but they make it work on the X-Files because there's always just enough progress with the characters, with the underlying story, with the overarching mythology, with the relationship first and foremost in my mind, that it makes it feel like there's something more to come and that we're moving towards something. We're not staying in place. We're always moving towards something.
Yep, absolutely.
I love it. I love this two-parter. It's one of my faves.
I agree. I think this is really strong. We're in like a really strong part of the mythology. I feel like this maybe next two or three seasons of mythology is the best. So
I agree.
Excited to dig deep into it, Jen. And so we won't be back for a few weeks at least. With more mythology, but then our next one is going to be Anasazi trilogy, which I'm super excited about.
Very, very stoked about that. I mean, Paperclip's one of my very favorite episodes of all time, and the other two parts are all working in tandem, and there's a lot to love in that three-parter, so I'm very excited about that.
That'll probably be a super-sized podcast app, just warning y'all.
I think it's gonna have to be, or you know, not necessarily warning you, but like giving you advanced excitement
exactly
about how supersized and how in depth and exciting and explosive that episode's going to be.
It will be. I'm very excited. Well, thanks you guys for listening. If you have any thoughts about Colony or Endgame, I know that there was a lot to cover in those. We probably missed plenty. So please tweet at us at XFD Podcast and let us know what you think of those episodes. And thanks again for listening. We'll be back with you next time on X-Files Diaries.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.